insect ball. The music is furnished by a cricket band. And all the insects were right on hand.
The bedbug had a special invite. He couldn't go, he had to work that night. Three rode up on a fine bull buck. Should have heard the band when it struck up.
Hopped in, she looked about. She didn't say a word, she just hopped back out.
While all the insects were filled with glee, the ant did the boogie with the bee.
There was a head bug, red bug, scared bug, dead bug.
Wrong bug, right bug, white bug, light bug.
Skinny bugs, fat bugs, thinny bugs, flat bugs, fly, flea, gnats, bees, and ants in the BVD. Just from France.
The termite got high and bit a groove in the floor. When they kicked him out, he had a hole in the door.
All good things must come to an end. The gnat opened a bottle that he thought was gin. He stepped to the bar for a drink and spree. What do you know? It was DDT.
Hey, Big J.
Yeah.
Dig them bugs. Insect
fat
ball.
Bugs, skinny bugs, long bugs.
Man, all kinds of bugs.
Yeah.
Jumping and jiving at that insect ball. You know, I get lots of requests for that one. That's a very popular song to this day.
Yeah.
That's Jesse Belvin and Mercy D are singing vocals on that song.
Yeah.
So that was on Imperial, too.
Yeah, that was on Imperial. We did a lot of things. See, at that time, I didn't think I could sing, so what I did, I always hired the singers. I always had singers all over. In fact, I was supposed to do Fever, because I was with, you know, King at that time. And the guy, I was working in New York, and my vocalist was hanging out in Providence, and he came up to me with the tune, man, you know. And, of course, now I'm doing a lot of singing. I'm going to sing you some of my stuff if you hear it, you know.
All right.
But, you know. I could have had Fever, you know. I had a guy who wanted me to do it, and then they gave it to Willie John. You know?
Oh, man. Now, you were talking before. I just want to touch on this one more time. You were talking before about how they pulled your permit because you were mixing the races. They didn't know why the white kids and the Hispanic kids were going crazy.
Yeah.
And now, as time progressed, as the 50s progressed, do you remember when your type of music, when race music, when R&B music became rock and roll and became the mainstream, things probably loosened up a little bit for you, didn't they?
Well, not necessarily. So the only thing that helped me out was with a powerful agency, and that was GHC. They booked Nat King Cole and all Sammy Davis and all the heavy cats, you know. And so when you work with a big agency, they'd get on the phone and call, hey, I want the guy. And they have to take you because they want the other acts. So that's why I was a privilege to work Birdland in New York, would say like all of the Chitlin' Group, Charles Brown, all the guys, they would work the Apollo, and you know they want to hang out in New York, but there was nowhere for them to work in New York, no real club. So, but I'd work the Apollo, then I'd go to Birdland. I was working Bandbox, Bandbox with Cab Calloway, work Birdland with Diz, Sarah, all the big acts, and because I'm with GAC, and that's why I was able to.
So they were putting you in the clubs to hit an older demographic. You weren't playing to the kids at those clubs in Berkeley.
No, no, well, no. Those clubs were, you know,
older people.
And once I performed, and then I had no problem. I was working Wildwood, New Jersey, working Philadelphia, and I worked the whole Apollo pit. Like it all depends what kind of manager you got. Man, I'm headlining the show, and here's the five girls that don't do it. top number of the country, but I'm headlining the show and and the Apollo, you know. But so it all who your agent is, that, you know, the recognition or position that you get.
So even in the late 1950s, after rock and roll had, you know, settled down, had you know, Little Richard was going strong, Fats Domino was going strong, Elvis was going strong. Even at that time, it was still not accepted for you to play to the screaming kids. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, at that time, it kind of, like you say, it did ease up a little bit. But what they did, they took the saxophone out and put the guitar in it. And it changed from rhythm and blues to rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And so when they changed the title of it, the same type of stuff, changed the title of it, then that's when Dick Clark came in. You know, for a long time, Dick Clark cleaned it up. Yeah, Dick Clark never had a black artist on the show for a long time. You know?
He bleached it.
Yeah, so, even back east, when this other guy that, what's his name out of Cleveland, I think, I can't think of his name now.
Alan Freed?
Yeah, because I did his show there in Cleveland.
I was just going to ask you about Freed, because the thing is, Freed loved the honking saxophones.
Yeah, I know, that's what I did. I did a show with him, because I worked Cleveland, like I said, I worked Cleveland, Pittsburgh, you know, all through it. Like I say, being with GAC, I worked that whole circuit, you know, and I worked for Alan Freed when he first started. So a lot of people think all this stuff happened back east, but it happened on the West Coast, you know, like Little Esther and Johnny Lewis had his big shows with all his people, you know. And so all this really happened on the West Coast.
Wow. Now, did you play any of the packaged Freed shows?
I did one, but not travel. I played on one in Cleveland, Ohio. And then that went, like, you know, at that time they had what they call the top 10. They would start in New York. They would start in New Orleans. And that's when we had to do two concerts, you know, one for the white, one for the black.
It was
tough then. And so that was the top 10 review. And I was supposed to back the band. I happened to know this guy from Gale Agency. And I saw him in New York, and he said, "You want to do the tour?" I said, "Yeah." So I was supposed to back all the acts and then do my performance. But when he got ready to do the show, Joe Turner wanted Chuck Camel, because the band had backed him. So he said, and they flew in about seven musicians to make a big band, you know. And they said, "Oh, man, this guy can't play my music." And I said, "Okay, so let Chuck Camel." I took up my same money, so I want to do maybe about...
Oh, you're telling me Big Joe turned you down?
Well, what happened is, Joe Turner wanted Chuck Campbell, a band that traveled with him.
Yeah.
So he tried to act like, we couldn't play his music.
Uh-huh.
You know? So he was trying to pull strings to get in.
Uh-huh.
So the guy said, "Okay, man, you know, I'll just pay you the same money. You just do your little act." And so, like, they had two buses.
Yeah.
And they put all the big acts on the nice bus, and they put the band on a little raggedy bus, you know. But the guy had told me about this, because I was playing behind Faye Adams doing some gigs.
Oh, Faye Adams.
So the guy was telling me how they treat the band, you know. So they said, "Well, okay, man, you can ride in the nice bus, but I'm going to put your band." I said, "Oh, no, man." So we just taken our own car and drove. And we got to the place, we had to sleep in our station wagon sometime, because they had all the rooms, you know. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
That big show, like you had the Five Keys, the Moon Glows, Still Satin, the Satins, the Robins, Etta James, Joe Turner, Little Richard, Bill Dawg, all these people on the show, packed, you know what I mean? So, you know, and when you got down there, man, you had to go to, in the black neighborhood, man, to get a room.
Hotel,
so, I mean, how many rooms did they have?
And so the hotels are booked, and after you play one of these killer shows, you end up sleeping in your car, because all the rooms in
gone.
The black part of town are booked.
Yeah. Gone, man.
That's crazy.
In fact, you couldn't even eat, man, you know, because, you know, you had to go to the back, you know. So we knew it. We got off one night, drove up to one of them driving. So we drove to the back, man, said, "We don't even want your money." So we just had to keep on going, you know.
Huh.
It was tough during that time, Donnie, man.
I have heard some horror stories about touring the South back in the 50s.
Oh, tough, man, tough.
What was one of the worst you can remember, one of the Georgia stories? Tell us a Georgia story.
Oh, well, this guy here, he would book, like, about 30 dates on us, and then he would sell them to other promoters. And so he would get a real good price, you know, he'd buy a block of dates. So what happened, we found out what was happening, and the guy wasn't paying us the kind of money, you know. So
wait, so this guy's kind of like a scalper, but for booking shows?
Yeah, so
he buys the dates, and then he kind of farms them out to people?
Yeah, and he would be on the gig, you know, and he was rolling the money, you know, and so we saw what was happening because see when you play the date then you're supposed to, like if you're getting $500, anything over $1,000 you're supposed to get 50%. Mm-hmm. I mean that's the arrangement they had. Whatever you get, you double it and you got the money. This guy was taking the money, and we weren't getting the money, so I went to a little small town. I got before he got there. And so I told the promoter what's happening. God said, you can play. So then he brought a band up there to play. Mm-hmm. So they went and got the sheriff and everything. And the guy said, hey, man, am I a good guy? And the guy said, yeah, you're a good guy. So he said, well, tell this guy to get these guys and get them out. So they got them out. So I don't know. I go back to Savannah, Georgia. I don't know what's happening. So what he does, he go down and tell the police we owe him money, and they confiscate my car. But they let us take our instruments out. Usually when they confiscate the car, they take everything. But they let us take our instruments. So we had a job to play in Augusta, Georgia. So we rented a car and went down and played, and he beat us down there and taking all the money. And so here we walking around anyway, no car, can't do nothing, you know, trying to make it. Jesse Bedman was all there.
All right. You had your vocal group with you, too.
Yeah, so what happened is that I told the guy, hey, man, I said, if you let me play for you tonight, everything will be all right, you know. So he said, okay. So we got the car. Filled up full of gas, you know, scuffling, man, you know. And so I called a union man, and the union man told him, said, man, these guys don't owe you no money. But so anyway, the union man said, you have your car? He said, yeah, get on out of town, man. So I weighed that, because he thought we was going to play that night, you know, mm-hmm. So I weighed that. So we was getting on out of town. I remember Johnny Oates was playing in a town right across the border line. So we drove up and had a good big time. So the police would say, you part of the band? I said, yeah, we just drove in. You know, John had his big bus and everything.
Oh, I see.
And so we got in, the guys gave us, we told them what's happening, and they all chipped in and gave us some money, and then we got on into Fort Worth, Texas.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah, it was quite a thing. But then I had to go back to Savannah when Duncan and them had the Earth Angel was traveling with them. So
was there a warrant for you?
Huh?
Did they have a warrant for you guys in Savannah?
No. See, what he did, what he would do, he would just go out and claim that we had to owe him money, and the police would come down and get the car. So this time I had to go back to play. We were traveling. So what I did, I had my agent send him a telegram. You know, we was coming. But what I did when I got in town, I wouldn't put my car in storage, man. And
I'm taking
a cab to the gig. But prior to that, I was in New York working in Apollo. The guy said, hey, man, you sure messed that guy up in Georgia, man. You didn't play that gig. I said, yeah, man, I was getting out of town, man. And because the guy said, man, get on out because he can pull your car in again, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, I went there to see him, you know. He said, man, I said, look, man, you know, you had my car and you weren't going to let it go, so I'm getting on out of town. So, you know, I told him I had to go, man, because I didn't want to be sitting up here. And that was a monster, man. And this was really rough down there. You know, it's not like after Martin Luther King come through, man.
Did this guy ever get caught? I mean, was he still pulling the scam?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, what can you do? You're down south, man.
Yeah, right.
And then the different artists is that he's dealing with black musicians, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, you're down south, you know. Yeah, you had nothing to say. Nothing, you know, it's tough.
That's a shame. That's a shame.
It was a tough time.
Well, it's still a dirty business, the music industry.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, like I have my own record company now. So I record what I want to record. I have some real nice. I did a jazz album. A kid named Skip wrote one. It's really nice. I did had five horns, flutes, and all that stuff on it.
Oh, very nice.
And I did I Want to Live and some Strange on the Shore. Some real nice things. All dead, no vocal, all instrumental. I'll send you one. I think
okay.
It's you might hear something on there you like, yeah. You know.
Now, one of your most recognizable records and one of your most frantic records is 3D.
Yeah, that's quite.
Are you playing with your brother on that? Who's the other sax on that?
Just my brother and I.
That's just your brother and you guys are three-dimensional on that record.
Yeah, well, the way we played, you know, we had a big sound, and I had a little white kid on guitar named Porgy, you know, he was like, we did the Goof, too, you know, that was wild. But the 3D was quite a thing, and I had a lot of problems. I'm like, go over Europe, and I want to play it, and the guys, it was very difficult for them to play it, you know.
Yeah.
And so I never forget, we was doing this big thing for the Dresden Bank. They're supposed to be a studio band, you know, and they're so big, you know. And so we had sent them a CD, but I had one guitar player that I work with in Germany. So we got ready to play because they hired me. I only do about 10 minutes, but they hired me for to create excitement, to come through the club screaming. That's
of
what
course.
I do.
Who else are they going to hire but you, Big J?
So that was my opening act. You know, I come through the, and I do that 3D, you know, and that's a monster changing king. And so, the guy, now this is supposed to be studio musician, working in studio, you know, and radio station, all that. And so, the guy said, "Well, you know, we can't play it, man. We didn't have time to listen to it. If we had some music," I said, "Well, here it is, you know, it's music." You know. I remember I had some, and then he set up the. I said, "Well, get the same thing as the drummer, and we never did play it, man." And so the only way I could play it, the bands that I had to teach them, you know, how to what to do. And then after I got the kids, they could play it, you know, after I rehearsed them, then they could play it. But other than that, just to walk in. The only time that they could really play it was in New York, and when I was inducted in the Hall of Fame, you know, from Washington there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had sent them, I had Deacon's Hop and I had 3D. Well, Deacon's Hop is cool to catch a groove, but I'm coming through the audience, and so I want to do 3D, you know.
Yeah.
And so a lot of guys that say you lay on the floor or something like that, talking, they figure you don't know. They don't know how much you studied, you know.
Right, yeah.
So when we got ready to do this, they wanted to do Deacon's Hop because that's easier, you know.
Sure.
I said, no, man, I want to do 3D because I'm coming to the audience and screaming and hollering, trying, you know, laying on the floor and all that. So I want some up tempo that we can teach inside. So we got ready to go into tune. Now, the rhythm section had it down, I mean, but the horns, they're going to jive and come in on the second. I said, no, I'll stop. I said, no, man, you come in on one. And when they found out, I knew what was happening. Then they played, you know. But guys that do that, you know, they if they figure you don't know what's happening,
yeah,
they misuse you. But then when they find out that I know what's happening, then things are a little different, you know.
Well, let's hear 3D right now because
okay.
You're jumping out of the radio, Adam.
Yeah.
New milk, new milk. New milk, new milk. New milk, new milk.
Milk! Milk, 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 milk!
Jay McNeely, who's on the phone with me right now from L.A. Now, Big J, that was a cool song. I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah, it was really great. A lot of kids, when I'm traveling to Europe, they love the Nervous Man, Nervous. You know, I did a thing, you know, I played a little place called Mospique. It cost about $10,000 a week to rent a house. That's where Prince Morgan house. And we know it was a different thing because the guy did the benefit anyway. But this guy was in another town out of Austria, Vienna, and he was down there, so I played for them, and so we did the thing, and they like all this kind of more of the disco stuff, so I got all into that, the Nervous Man, Nervous, and everything. It's a monster, so yeah, this is a great tune for me.
Yeah. Now, in the late 1950s, 1959, you scored what was your biggest pop success. I mean, Deacon's Hop was a huge rhythm and blues tune, but There's Something on Your Mind was your biggest pop success.
Yeah, it was a big tune for me. It's a funny thing when we recorded this thing. We recorded in the guy's basement up in Seattle, Washington, and we didn't have any money to get out. You know, we're scuffling musicians then. So I came back a year later. I knew I had a hit because every place we play it, man, people just love it. They didn't know the title of that song, just cross your mind, whatever it was. You know?
Yeah, right.
They wanted to hear the tune. So we got off from work one night, a little sunny, and we all went in the studio. And this guy would record all the bands that would come through Seattle, Washington. So I went back and I got the tape. I brought it to Hollywood. Little Hal Singer, you know, he was the guy that booked a lot of things. I've taken it down to all the companies, you know, and they said, oh, no, we don't want that, it's nothing. So Holland Hancock was open, getting ready to open a record company with Devonport. So what he would do is make a tape of it and put it on the air. If he got any response, then he would put it out. You know, he wasn't going to invest the money, you know. And so because he liked me, he said, okay, I'll go ahead and print it up. So he said, Big J, this not going to be nothing. But he said, for you, I'll put it out. I said, okay. So I know I had a hit record. So we was back in Bobby Darin and Chuck Berry. We was getting I was only getting $150 a night, man. I had to have a six-piece band, man. And we had to pay traveling. And we had to pay traveling tax, you know, 10% traveling tax. So I knew I had a record. So we got to San Francisco. A guy named Rockin' Lucky came on at 12 o'clock at night. And I put that record on, man. There is something. Man, this town went crazy, man. Mm-hmm. And he was the only one had the record, you know. So, because, you know, like, usually you send you put your records into the distributors and try to get them into the store. You know, you go that way. But I went the other way. I put it on the air. And so everybody was calling the stations trying to find it, trying to go to the record company, couldn't
That's
find
great.
It, calling the distributor. Nobody had a record, but the record was tearing the town. Everybody went. So the only way they could hear it, they'd have to hear it on their show. So the next day I called Hunter. I said, man, you got to get some records up here, man, because this thing is taking off. So I had to go on. I was continuing on back in Bobby Darin and Chuck Berry, went all the way up to Seattle, played. And we came back within 1 week, and we drew, with B.B. King, we drew 5,000 people in the Oakland Auditorium with There's Some Money in Mine. So by being on a small label, we got a lot of coverage. Like the Hollywood Four Flames, they covered it with Specialty. And so they hit Pittsburgh, so people thought they were the one, you know.
Uh-huh.
Then Bob Monchan picked it up in New York.
New Orleans. Yeah.
And so the only way that I got the tune, you know, is that I was traveling. So every radio station I'd go in, I'd get off and put the record on, you know. And I remember one year we had a battle of singers with Bob Monchan, Lil Sonny, and the Phoenix, Arizona. And that was quite a concert.
Man, I bet.
Oh, man, it was a monster.
What I love about that record is that you got Lil Sonny, who sounds just great on that. Just really fits the record great. But the other thing is, you got Wild Big J McNeely, you know, kind of hanging back a little bit. Like, you when you play 3D, Nervous Man, Nervous, you know, all those crazy records where you're just, you know, blowing as fast as you can. And then you really hung back and just blew a real mournful sax.
Yeah, well, like when the kid first had it, when I heard the tune, the guy who wrote it, he liked Fats Domino, you know. And I said, no, man, you have to cut this thing in half, man, you know. So we just cut everything in half and just laid it in there. And Little Sonny loved Ray Charles. And he swear, if you turn your back, you swear it was Ray Charles, man, because he came out of the gospel down south. He had a lot of soul, man. And so I said, no, man, you sang it exactly the way it is on this tape. And that's what he did, and it turned out to be a big hit.
It was a big hit, and that's I'm going to close our time together with There's Something on Your Mind, with Little Sonny singing. And I hope to have you back on the show real soon, Big J.
Man, I sure appreciate this interview, man. It's great.
And you're playing at Bruno's.
Yeah, that's Gardena and Figueroa.
And
it's right
not,
on the corner.
Not this Wednesday, but
next Wednesday,
you'll be there every other Wednesday.
Yeah.
So I hope people in Los Angeles come and check you out.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you, Matt.
There is something on your mind. Now the way you look at me. There is something on your mind. Will it bring misery?
about me. If I ever cross your mind, if I ever cross your mind, well, you know I'm yours, and I know you're mine. Do 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 do.
And if you dig these sounds, make it to Dolphins of Hollywood, 1065 East Vernon, for the lowest prices on records anywhere in Los Angeles. Any 45 RPM record is only 88 cents. Any $3.98 Monaural LP is only $2.98. And any $4.98 stereo LP is only $3.98. Get your records at Dolphins of Hollywood, and you won't have to listen to my program to hear your favorite records. And they've got everything. Rhythm and blues, jazz, spirituals, a tremendous stock of oldies, and they even have a few 78 RPM records still available. So, if it goes around to make a sound, you'll find it at Dolphins. You can get that great record by Big J. McNeely, There's Something on Your Mind, The Drifters, There Goes My Baby, The Coasters, Charlie Brown, Fats Domino's, I'm Ready, and all the rest of the big hits that you're hearing here on Huttin' with Hunter on KGFJ. Dolphins is open weekdays till 4 a.m. and Sundays from 10 till 10. Be sure to tell them that old HH sent you down to 1065 East Vernon to Dolphins of Hollywood.